of that expression, T
yes.
slash
T or S. Small parameters, yeah.
Indeed, yeah, and you might be able to throw some light on how, not so much how those parameters came about, but the fact that you more or less knew the guy. Because you're so old. Back again for another installment of Not an Audiophile. Today we speak to Brad Serhan again, renowned loudspeaker designer, worked around the world, admittedly mostly in Australia, but he has done designs that have been sold everywhere. Today is episode 4. We're going to speak to him again about the period of his earlier brand, Orpheus, and how it's progressed to ultimately conjoin with Maurice Swift and become Serhan and Swift. Without any further ado, Brad Serhan. Brad Serhan is on the line for round number 2 of the history of Orpheus. And bar one question that I want to kick off with, this segment, hour, is really about the 90s and entering into the new millennia. Exciting stuff. And
it is.
But I want to just to get you warmed up and primed and in the mood for discussing all those wonderful stories from the old days.
Yes.
It occurs to me that you, while at uni, were in the presence on a number of occasions of a famous loudspeaker guru in the form of Mr. Small.
Professor
Dick Small? Yes. Yeah,
that or Doctor of... Yeah, I think that might be.
I think Professor. Well, I'd say surely Professor, I would have thought.
Yes.
Not... You can tell how much research I've done. I mean, the guy guy and his friend are well known by the expression TS parameters.
T or small parameters, yeah.
Indeed, yeah. And you might be able to throw some light on how, not so much how those parameters came about, but the fact that you more or less knew the guy.
Harking back to, I think this is going right back to probably 1979, though. I might have touched on it in the last podcast. I was desperate to garner information on T or small parameters. I sort of just started to read about that sort of stuff then when I was at uni, and then I knew that Small was there, Professor Small was there at the university.
On a higher floor.
Much higher floor.
Yes.
Yeah, my neck was craned from looking up and saw. But anyway, I went to the electrical engineering part of the building, and someone put me in contact with him. I discovered that he was there, still lecturing, and I knew of him already from my reading. So I thought, shit, I better get to meet him and see if he'd actually talk to me.
So at that stage, he wasn't really, I was going to say he wasn't a household name. He was never a household name. What I meant to say was he was perhaps not as universally well known at that stage, because the papers and the concept was just a happening thing, or had been around for a few years, I guess. But all were you somewhat starstruck? Is where I'm going.
Yes, because one, he knew infinitely more than me. Number two, I knew of his notoriety with regards to Teal's small parameters and the papers that he had done following up from Neville Teal's. Because I'd read those papers, and once I discovered that he was based in Sydney at Sydney University, I thought, bugger this! I'm going to see if he'll have a chat with me about a couple of things. And I think I went up with some lame idea of chatting to him about RG and taking that into account when you're calculating the QTS of a driver and trying to, you know, tune the base reflex system.
Well, you had to have a reason.
Something else.
You had to have a reason.
And also his port correction, or I can't remember. So, but he seemed very, very nice fella, and he gave me, he wrote this stuff, the formulas down for me. And then it was just making that connection, I suppose, and it did help me, but I didn't pester him after that.
Did he write the formulas down off the top of his head in front of you on a piece of paper?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, his brain was clearly dramatically more agile than mine now is. But what age was he at that stage, do you think? I mean, he would have appeared old to you as you were 12 years of age, but you seem like a 50-year-old or younger?
I would say, well, it's funny you should say that. My memory was he's, I would think he would have been about 40.
Yeah, okay.
My guess about, look, I was, what, 23.
Okay.
At the time, so I'm trying to look it up on Google now as we speak, but I haven't been adroit enough to discern that. Anyway,
at some point appeared in the distant future. There will be a researcher sitting beside us who will look things that up. Yeah, in real time.
Yeah, but look, he. I'm there, I hope he's still alive. Anyway, he went on to Kef. I'm pretty sure he left
kind of rings of
Sydney Uni, and then he went on to Kef and did research there.
Yeah.
Where
he taught Andrew Jones everything he knows today.
Very possibly, yeah. I'm not sure about
that. I'm not sure. I think Andrew Jones, from his stories, was working under someone else. But, he might, don't know. But anyhow. Okay, so I guess it's an interesting connection that he was, as you remind me, though, he was Australian in the sense that many Australians are Australians, but they weren't necessarily born here, but we still regard them quite correctly as Australians. But he was possibly Canadian, of Canadian heritage?
That's my memory. He would have been Canadian or American, but
that's really, really annoying, isn't it? You know, you really want him to be an Australian.
What he did is he landed in Australia, lobbed into Australia, and followed up with Neville Teal's fine work.
Yes,
and Teal released his stuff, I think, around 61, 62, and he was an Australian, so. Nominally Australian,
I mean, look, it doesn't really matter. We'll regard him as Australian in the same way as Russell Crowe and Sam Neill are all Australians.
Yeah, that's right. Especially if they do really good things. So he was a pip. Like, I suppose that was that brush with someone who knew so much and he was generous with his time, so I really appreciated that. And it was just that launching point, I suppose, 1980, when I started to sort of design my first speaker, which I spoke about last time we chatted.
I would imagine it would have spurred you on, like, you know, from the point of view that such a gentleman would at least not put you off the industry, so to speak.
No, that's right.
If he was some kind of Marco Pierre White character who was sort of, you know, pointing and spitting, he might have, look, go away, child, come back in 10 years' time when you know something, kind of thing. Might have made you think differently about this otherwise quite fun industry to be involved with. Jumping completely sideways. So the decade rolls on, and at the end of that decade, you've built a loudspeaker business. You're turning quite reasonable numbers. The product is now in dealers around the country, pretty much. maybe 91, 92 or something, you sort of...
Yeah, so if we step back across the 1990 threshold, it was sort of 87. I can't remember whether we discussed this in the last episode. It was 87 I got the Orpheus speakers into my first retailers, and I think I touched on that with the last episode. So Len Wallace, Music by Design, and you know six shops in Sydney,
It's utterly amazing, isn't it?
Because you could not. No dealer now would sort of put up with. And fair enough, you don't want to have three or four dealers carry a product because they'd be too much. You know, dealers want to be able to be profitable, which is fair enough.
Well, I don't want too much, you know, arguing with the opposition, I suppose, over, you know, the same product. But the price-wise, you know. But the, I mean, you wouldn't get, I doubt there are six dealers in Sydney today selling BMW. So that was...
That's right.
It's quite a breakthrough, really.
Well, it's not me beating my chest about how many dealers it got. Maybe it is. But it was more the fact that when you think about that in 1988, 87, 88, 89, people seem to be, you know, sticking to their local areas generally. I mean, sure, they might have driven around to do that, but it was perfectly acceptable, apparently, for Orpheus or Richter, you know, the other brands to be out there and in so many shops.
Yeah.
Which is surprising. That wouldn't happen now.
No, I wouldn't, but I think people, are certainly more mobile and, of course, ultimately or infinitely more mobile with, scouring the internet. So,
absolutely.
So
the point of me bringing that up is that sort of, as I went from sort of 88, 89 into 90, we'd start to consolidate dealers and it was interesting that the Australian dealers suddenly the market turned. There was a sort of sense that it was okay to buy Australian. That there were other Australian brands out there as well. So Richter, obviously, Colin Watmore's Watmo loudspeakers, had been going longer than me. Got to get my grammar right. Duntech was starting to really hit its straps.
Well, actually, there's a thing, isn't there? Because the infamous, or famous, not really infamous, episode of Towards 2000, where the Duntechs, the big suckers, were featured. For those not familiar with the show, it was an ABC TV show, which... back in the days when there was a handful of channels, and so a national audience saw an Australian-made pair of loudspeakers presented as being exceptional. And my memory is that they recorded a performance live and then played it back for the Towards 2000 presenters or the audience to try to decide, to hear the difference or be deceived as to what was live or recorded music, which of course even then I chuckled at. But fantastic exposure for Australian made loudspeakers there on that night.
Yeah.
I don't know what year that was, but maybe that played a role because that was mid to late 80s actually, was it? Or was it late 80s, do you think?
Would have thought it was late 80s, but
yeah. Okay. So it may have played some role in that change where people regarded, you know, an Australian designed and manufactured product as a suitable thing to spend their money on.
Yeah, it was the sort of thing that opened the door in a sense.
Hmm. Okay.
I'm just typing in now just to confirm that. Just to get a sense of us having some, and it looks like I'm just trying to fool the experts. Apparently, And of course, there's no date.
It fooled the experts. Yeah. Okay. Well, that was it. Was a great story, and it was exposure that, you know, money couldn't buy.
Sadly, they haven't come up with a bloody date here. I'm just poor at scrolling through. But anyway,
I can't search the internet and talk at the same time.
Well, I've just shown that I can't either. Let's just cut this section out, mate. My apologies for that.
Well, I think the audience is entirely capable of pressing a few keys and showing us up as being far more expert at finding this information out. But my childhood memory is I'm going to say mid to late and 80s.
This time round, I said to you earlier, before we press record, that I was going to be more lucid vis-a-vis information, and I have now failed that miserably. So let's take two. Let's just talk in general terms. What happened was Paul Keating made a statement back in 1986, if I remember rightly, about Australia becoming a banana republic because we were buying too much imported stuff.
Indeed.
So good on you, Paul. That helped because suddenly there was a little bit of a let's look at Australian-made stuff. The timing of Ralph Waters and myself going out and touting the loudspeakers around, and no doubt Colin Watmore and other people, and Duntech, suddenly there was a bit of interest from local Australian dealers. So, and the fact that they were open-minded and they gave a few of us a crack, fantastic. So, and then we started to establish a bit of a footprint, if you like, a sonic footprint.
Mm.
And it was then a case that it was okay to be Australian and Australian made, or standard designed or whatever. So yeah. So that got us to 1990. We were starting to establish that little bit of territory, if you like, in terms of shops that had our speakers, not just in Sydney, but around the New South Wales country and then Queensland and Victoria. I think we got up to I'm going to go back to Walter Brennan, the old guy who has played a role in The Real McCoys and another cowboy TV show. And he's an old guy, and he used to go, "No brakes, yes fact." I don't know why I remember that rubbish, but anyway, no brakes, yes fact. Anyway, we had 26 or 12, 27 stores.
Wow.
Now that's not a bragging. That is just how the hell there were that many shops back then.
Well, you know,
that many that would be stupid enough crazy enough to take on our product.
It was a different time.
It was a different time. So anyway,
can I cut in and just for the audience that my knowledge of the late 80s, early 90s is that there was probably 100 to 130, or maybe even as many as 150.
Right.
Somewhat specialist hi-fi stores across the country, and now there's 20, what did you just say, 26 or 28 you got up to? How many?
I think it's 27 stores.
27. So there's hardly any more than 27 specialist hi-fi stores in the country now. Certainly up and down the East Coast, that's about, there's a touch over 30, I guess. But, you know, and then plus a handful, you know, through SA and WA. Not even sure there is a specialist hi-fi store in Darwin anymore. And, you know, that's weird. There was one in every regional town, if not two or three. Yes. And
now, what we found with that, though, Andrew, was, of course, that, Kiet joined me around 1993, I think, or 92.
So a pivotal moment. So we'll just hold that thought. So 93, Kiet Lowe became somehow, you know, was giving you a hand, I guess, but because this is the decade we were meant to be talking about, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's what I was building into, that we actually I was doing this by myself up until Tony Wong and Kiet Lowe joined forces with me. So the upshot, why I'm telling you this, the upshot is that there were the long road trips up to various stores around the place.
Mm.
and securing the dealers. And it started to roll forward at a reasonable rate. We started to get some reasonable press from Hi-Fi magazine reviews, and but I was probably starting to struggle being able to supply. Not probably, I was struggling to supply.
Well, as a one-man show, I mean, you were, I mean, do you want to talk about what volume you were trying to create basically by yourself? Or is that, you know, secret information? But I mean, the numbers will be quite high compared with what we all do as smaller manufacturers today. I mean, I've seen photos, you know, out at the cabinet factory that you're involved with, where there was a lot of speakers being assembled. Although that might have been all Ralph's.
That's very good.
Do we talk about?
No, to be fair, quite a few of those enclosures or cabinets were Ralph's.
Yeah. Okay.
But effectively, when I was a one-person show, I had a cabinet maker, of course, so it wasn't just one. So I had a cabinet maker and a couple of great cabinet makers. One I can't, an Italian fellow that was in Summerhill, great guy.
Yep.
Did beautiful work. And then Terry, who I met through the PMI Hi-Fi people.
Mm-hmm.
Terry is a fireman that also worked on these days off with making cabinets.
Yep.
And did a very bloody good job as well. And then I'd do assembly crossovers and do a lot of the assembly out at the cabinet makers to make it easier to do a production run.
Yes.
And then I think from memory, I'm not sure whether Kit had joined. I think Kit and Tony had joined me 93, and I think we then went across to JJ Cabinets, mm-hmm. Graham from JJ Cabinets.
Yep.
So, and that worked nicely because, again, I was able to take the crossovers down to Graham's and just you'd have an assembly line approach to things.
Which is kind of the thing I've seen the photos of, I think, where you've got lots of boxes
that's right.
lined up. Yeah. I mean, it looked like a proper
factory. So to answer your question, big fella.
Yeah.
To answer your question, in terms of turnover, I had a little red book, little red and black book, and it's somewhere here. I honestly can't quite remember how many.
It doesn't really.
It was 20. It got going. It actually got going for the Dolomites, the Minotaurs, the Apollos, which I was running back then. And then it got going nicely. Then we introduced a model which was below 1,000, which was called the Metaphor, which is a twin four design.
Yes.
And that was manufactured by Colin Mort.
Mm-hmm.
Morton, I think it was Morton Acoustics. Colin's a great guy. He generously said, "Brendan, I'll give you good paying terms." And we got on really well. And so he made 100 cabinets for me.
Yeah.
But he did some prototype or pre-production enclosures. So I went out with that design and touted them around the stores and pre-sold them.
Yeah, okay.
So suddenly, of the 100 made, I probably pre-sold 55 or 60 to stores because
wow.
they were below the $1,000 mark. And that was when we were around that time at 25 to 27, 27 stores. And it meant that I knew that I could afford to pay Colin.
Yes.
And that's when I started to turn over. I had the more expensive models, the more, you know, we'll use the term, more audiophile, high-performance speakers, the Minotaur, the Dolomites, the Apollo models. And
well, you can use the word audiophile.
It's not an audiophile.
Well,
is it okay to?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what the rules are. I haven't quite made them up yet, but, I mean, I guess really the gist of the not an audiophile is that we're probably not audiophiles. We're more, you know, designers, manufacturers, fixer-uppers, installers, what have you. But
people who want to appeal to audiophiles and music lovers.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. I mean, I just love the term music lover, equipment lover, whatever. I don't know. Yeah. To not spend minutes on it, but the audiophile, it's just the word back as a child.
A file.
I was kind of, see, I started in hi-fi retailing when I was 16, and the people that I worked with kind of hated audiophiles, right? I mean, the word wasn't really around then, but they
it's a pejorative. It's a pejorative term.
They sort of may have. It was in a regional town, but it was still, because there was hi-fi dealers everywhere, there was lots of business being done, and there was and there was the point is that there was a few hobbyist type customers, and there were two kinds of them. There were the ones that bought things and the ones that never did. And the gag really was that how many times can I speak to this guy and never sell them anything? And it wasn't that they were buying it somewhere else. There was nowhere else to buy it without driving for hundreds of kilometres. And there was not mail order, as we called it back then, wasn't really a big thing. But so there was this, you were sort of, you know, how you absorb things as a teenager. I guess I was... my head was messed with as far as the more extreme end of the hobbyist sector of customers. When you consider that 99% of the people we dealt with came in, listened to stuff, said, "So that sounds fantastic. Can I buy it?" Yes, done.
Good. So, whereas what you maybe the word buff. I mean, or, buff me, baby. I mean, but buff. Audio buff. Oh, yeah, I haven't heard the word buff in ages.
No, buff's not.
But I like a bit of buffy.
Buff.
You know what I mean? I'll be buff.
Buff's good.
You know, stuff like that.
Yep.
Oh, what are you? I'm an audio buff. Boffin, buff.
You're more the boffin and they're the buff.
P-H-I-L-E. Eh?
I think, you're more the boffin and they're more the buff, are they? The boffin is more the engineer and the boffin and the buff is more the enthusiast.
You still have your engineers buying, but I take your point, Andrew, that I just like the idea of maybe buff. it has got, you feel polished and, you know, when you've been buffed, it's either you've been doing a lot of workout stuff and getting that six pack, or he's buffed, that's a modern day parlance, oh, he's a bit buffed, or she.
Buff this. But,
yeah, or buffless. But the other thing is, buff in the old days is, you know, I can remember the old man would say to me, "Brad, duck down the front yard and just give the old car a bit of a buff with the polish, would you?
If
I've just washed the car. Go and buff it, if you would."
Well, I...
audio sham. What about audio shammy? I mean, the file word's redundant nowadays. But look, let's not decry people who are audiophiles, because they're the same as that. They love their music. And I love, buffing around.
Well, the English language is, notoriously changing constantly. And
it is. It's evolving.
It's sometimes hard to cope with the change as an older person. There was a time when a Mickey Mouse watch meant that it was shit. And, there was a time when something was Mickey Mouse meant that it was crap, because it was a trinket that you'd got at Disneyland for a dollar.
Yeah.
And then, at least in this country, at some point during my, younger life, it changed from being a piece of crap to something that a whole lot of people would now describe as Mickey Mouse, as in it's
Mickey Mouse,
fantastic. You
just spy to that.
Oh, absolutely. This is astounding. Yeah. This is the state of the Mickey Mouse art. So, whatever. So stuff changes. But, audiophile kind of didn't exist, but I was...
But did audiophile... Yeah. Oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to finalise my point. It was simply that I was... We had a bit of a snigger out the back at the people who talked a lot of crap and never bought anything, and I guess it stuck. And, look, I've spent a further lifetime in retail, and I'm not as afflicted as I once was. But anyhow, it seemed like an okay name for a podcast.
Jaundice is the word, jaundice bite.
Indeed.
But it goes back to the days, and I appreciate your situation when you were 16, 17, 18, and people not buying.
Young and impressionable.
And it reminds me, as in the last podcast, when I'd have people, when I was doing the Trading Post sell.
Yes, yes.
you're providing a service, and with it, albeit it could well have been a library service to listen to music, just a bit of conversation, and that's what I suppose you're going to have people who are going to do that, and that must have happened in the hi-fi shop sense as well, that you see people kick a few audio tires and see what they can.
Well, yeah. I mean, and look, it's entirely understandable. I mean, you know, you kind of expect it. But as a car enthusiast, I don't go around and hang around the Ferrari dealership. It's sort of, you know, and the thing is, the joy for them is they just kick you out. They go, mate, you're in the wrong shop. You know, Ford's up the road. Just zip up there. You've got the wrong F. Whereas, you know, you don't get to be, I've always been polite to all people, and there'll be people listening going, he wasn't polite to me once, he was quite rude, but he said that, we won't go into the intricacies of it, but, you know, anyhow, I think we went off at a bit of a tangent there.
My fault, I apologise.
We were 27 stores. Is where we were at, and
okay. So
and you said some audiophiles had, yeah, audiophile products is where we were at. Yes.
Yeah. So we had a high performance line. And
I just used the word without being nasty about it.
So, no, you did, and that's perfectly fine. I'm a high performance line.
I'm growing.
It didn't matter. It's a high performance line which helped. Was the icebreaker or whatever, for the metaphor to get out there, you know, $700 or whatever it was.
Mm.
And that started to kick. Now, thanks to people like Colin Mort, that helped. And then Tony Wong, my dear friend Tony Wong, who used to sell my speakers at Milverson Sound, he was one of the six dealers.
Yeah.
Tony knew a bloke by the name of Kietlo, who we've mentioned before. And Kit was interested in potentially joining forces with Tony, and Tony was going to put the surly tonto, as I like to call it, you know, the hard word on me.
Yes.
And I thought it was appealing because I thought, yeah, I'm starting to struggle with getting the speakers out the door with the high performance line, if you like, and Kit was going to bring hard work ethic in, and so was Tony. Tony was going to go out and help sell, and you know, go around the shops, and yep. That started us off in this three-way partnership back in '93, I think it was. And that made a difference.
Yeah, no doubt.
Kit was an architect originally. But was also doing a lot of advertising because he had, you know, a very, very modern Apple computer back then, and was doing all sorts of advertising for various retailers, Napa Electronics and stuff like that. Okay. So he was drawing an income in to bolster the Orpheus income. So it helped, you know, purchase drivers, etc. But also kept brought in a... He had a high work ethic. He's just one of those blokes that just, you know, pushed hard. I'm not saying I didn't push hard. I was pushing hard, but he came in with that sort of, let's get this done. I'll get that done. You do this. And he was a good foil. Oh yeah. We argued a bit and all the usual stuff that you do, but
sorry, argued a bit.
Oh, occasionally, like he was a funny bloke.
What?
And some would say I was a funny bloke. So
before Smoko, or did you just wait till lunchtime?
You're teasing me out there. What would happen is, Tony was, and here's the story that I worked out. Kit, I hope you don't mind me saying this, Cobber. I drive down to Lugano, and he was renting premises down there near his house. So I moved out of my work premises, my house, and started working down there because we had three really good rooms we could work with. And I would come in to the into the Lugano workshop, and if I had a coffee in the morning, I worked out I shouldn't have a coffee in the morning.
Right.
Because Kit would be slightly agitated in the morning, and I used to get in at 9:30 or something like that, or 10, because I was used to designing and working at my own hours. So,
sorry, you got in at 9:30 or 10?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'd work back later. Anyway, oh. Upshot was like, you know, anyway, you probably cut this bullshit out anyway.
So you were
anyway,
working Brad was, hours. Yeah, okay. So
So what happened was that I worked out because if I had the caffeine, that I was hypersensitive to him being slightly toey or doing stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? We'd argue over inane things, but not in a bad way. And I realized, because we were side by side, you know, side saddle, I'd be working on the computer, blah, blah, doing measurements, and he'd be doing some other stuff. I worked out if I don't have the coffee in the morning, I'm calmer.
Yes.
And then he was fine, I was fine, and then I'd have my coffee at lunchtime and we were fine. So
there was like a witching hour sometime between when you rolled into work, apparently as early as 9 o'clock, hard to believe.
I mean, that's just, yeah.
That happened once. And then sometime between that time and midday, there was a delicate balance. And then after that, everything was fine.
Yeah, fucking earth. Excuse me.
Certainly, it seems
this wasn't every day, but he would do things loudly to sort of indicate he was doing work. And he would disagree with that now. He would loudly, he's doing, you know, moving stuff around. And I was thinking, no, don't. You're just trying to say to me that you're working, and I'm working at the computer on the speakers. And I thought, I hit the keyboard harder so he could hear what I was working.
Well, the thing is, I mean, if you were at a computer working in the early to mid 90s, you were almost certainly working or maybe playing solitaire. You certainly weren't surfing the internet. So,
No.
That's
no,
a great that's old true. Expression, surfing the internet. You know what that's I mean? Right. You weren't.
But I'm only bringing
doing
up
some Facebooking or something.
Oh, stuff. Yeah. There was no such thing back then. And the point I'm making is that with any partnership or you know, with you know, Tony was out in the road. So Kit and I just got used to each other, and but it was occasionally there was a bit of frisson, but I think it sort of made us closer because we're still great mates now, and we laugh at some of the antics we got up to.
Like there was that infamous story you once told me about the that happened on the footpath or something out the front. But anyhow, that's another story.
That's another story.
So
we both survived, and the good news is Kit, Kit and I then drove all the way north, and I think we visited you. We did the big northern trek.
Did you go all the way to Cairns? I think did you or most no?
Yeah,
you did.
Oh, no, almost. We started our trek to Cairns and thought, how much longer we've got to go? And we looked at each other and said,
we're not going to make it.
It was hot. And we looked at each other, let's just fly up there, Kit said. Yeah. There is a classic story. I think it's a classic story.
Well, just to give the listener a sense of scale, I always find it hilarious that it's about 950 or 1,000 Ks to Brisbane from Sydney. And then it's, you know, there's 100 K steps up the coast to each town for a while.
Yeah,
and then but Cairns is still 1,700 kilometres north of Brisbane, so it's a big state. So
it's a very big state.
Yeah. Although when you think about it, you know, there's a fair bit of country south of Sydney. So I suppose the New South Wales coastline is 1,600 K. So
yeah.
But anyhow,
no, it's a bit of anyway.
But yeah, you're right. If you're the wrong time of the year, you don't want to go too far north.
No. But the interesting thing about that, so Kit, I'll get back to that classic story about traveling north and doing all those demos to various dealers. Having Tony and Kit arrive, and it meant that we started to get, had the ability to go out and tout for more business. Also, production levels went up, and we were able to supply dealers in Melbourne we started to we break through into Melbourne in 89 90. Leading edge audio trends, and eventually Tivoli. We started to get a roll on, which is fantastic. So
indeed. I should say we should have a quick break just for the purposes of making sure the recording's actually working. I mean, the numbers are changing, so I guess it's working. But let's finish that thought, which I've probably stopped you from. You probably don't remember where you're up to now. You'd broken into Melbourne, and then...
Yeah, and then we... Yeah, but did you want to have a break?
Well, you could finish the point, which I shouldn't have cut you off on, but...
This feels like a normal conversation.
If you could remember what the hell it was,
the recording button on.
Well, this is the point. I've forgotten because you know it's the good old days. What I want to do is I'll have a break and then I want to come back and I want to fast forward through the 90s, to some degree, but picking out where was the peak. I'm interested to know where things were powering. Because I feel like, you developed the range of the new era of Orpheus to some degree must have started not long after what we're speaking of now. The business seemed to, the product was everywhere is what I'm trying to say. And there seemed to be broad acceptance at some point. I'm thinking mid to late 90s, but I mean, you know, anyhow. We'll be back in literally no time at all. Hi, Andrew here. Same Andrew as who was just talking to the guest. I run a business called Hi-Fi and Stereo. In fact, I don't really run it. Sharon Hayden runs it, and you can speak to her whenever you want about getting your high-quality hi-fi equipment fixed. That's right. We do a lot of technical work for various people on various types of things, but my area of expertise is high quality home hi-fi equipment and all of the stuff you would expect: turntables, tape decks, amplifiers, DACs, loudspeakers, etc. If it's home hi-fi, then we can fix it for you. We're based in Brisbane in Australia, so if you are in the US or Europe, we can't help you. But anywhere in Australia we can. We do have equipment shipped in from all over. So if you would like a high-quality repair done on a high-quality piece of equipment, it is what we do. It's like a little boutique of hi-fi repairs. So get in touch. Further information at hifiandstereo.com.au. Thanks for listening. Hey, folks, we're back. It was a long break for us, but in fact probably only took 30-odd seconds for the listener. So, Brad... Brad Sirhan, by the way, Take Two. What the fuck is the word for the guy who started fucking Orpheus? Not the originator, the founder,
creator,
fuck me.
The founder.
All right, Take Two, hand clap. Hey, folks, we're back. Not an audiophile podcast, recorded in the studios of Hi-Fi and Stereo in Brisbane, Australia. The studio being a desk with a very inexpensive recording device parked nearby. We're interviewing today Brad Sirhan from originally Orpheus Loudspeakers. And
hi again.
Hello, Brad. And we, as per episode one of this marvellous podcast, we're discussing the travails of Orpheus Loudspeakers and ultimately moving on to, in the future, Sirhan and Swift, which is Brad's current... trading name for his excellent Mu2, Mu3, or is it the FU3? No, it was FU2. It was going to be the FU2, wasn't it?
No.
Well, it was the Mu2.
Yeah,
Mu2. But then the floor and standard would be the FU2.
Well, FU3, which sounds a little licentious, but lewd.
I think FU2 is so more licentious, but...
But Morris, my Swift, my marvelous partner, he didn't mind the idea of the FU, because F standing for floor standard, the FU3.
Okay.
But we thought it might be better just to go Mu3 or MU3F for floor.
Yes. So that's kind of out now, isn't it? Or
it is.
We're jumping sideways, but
we're jumping sideways. I just want to mention Morris. Morris and I, Sirhan Swift, Marvis Morris Swift. Anyway, I've used Marvis too many times.
Engineer of some note. So we.
Some note.
And we're going to, talk to Morris in a future, not too far into the future, but a future broadcast.
Episode.
So three things I want to briefly cover because we're going to wrap this up in the next 12.76 minutes. And that is, I'm interested to build up towards what you feel was the highlight of the 90s as far as volume, the amount of dealers and the excitement factor. But you wanted to also talk about a couple of things so far away. There was the input from the quite well-regarded English engineer who at the time worked with Wilson Benesch. There was also the famous brawl on the footpath out the front of the premises. Or was that not what you wanted to talk about?
I was going to talk about that, but
And then there was the new models that propelled Orpheus, the brand, into some level of stardom, really.
Well,
almost surpassing the infamous Ralph Waters product, but...
I dare say that. Okay. Yeah, no, well, look, just trying to collate my thoughts. Okay, so we had the metaphor burst forth. That was the speaker that was below $1,000 and started to sort of snare a few shops. And then we came out with another model, which started to change names. Rather than having Minotaur, Metaphor, Dolomites, Apollos, we went into CS-28, CS-18.
Oh, that's right. And
that was on Kiet's prompting. But look, doesn't matter.
I think I sold a few of those at one point. CS-28 rings a bell. Yeah, okay. So,
CS-28 was a larger floor-standing Metaphor, and we brought that out in about 1994. So it was another version, a bigger version of the Metaphor. And it, again, was sort of just dropping that price down to sort of quasi-compete with Richter and a few other brands, obviously, that price point, so we could start to get some turnover, the notion being we're a little bit more profitable. And that started to get kick-start us into more stores, and we started to get a little bit more turnover. We still aspire to do the sort of more high-end stuff, so we're still continuing down that line. Mm. And I'm just trying to – apologies for this. I'm trying to remember when it started to really roll. I think what happened was we managed a couple of things. One, we managed to get into the ABC.
Yeah.
And – That was something I always coveted. One, I love radio and all that sort of stuff. And a bloke by the name of Phil Carrick, who purchased a pair of Orpheus Dolomites back from the music room, Greg Long and Les Davis and co. Back in 1989. Phil owned a pair of Orpheus Dolomites. I went and installed them at his place, and we became great mates. He loved the sound of the Orpheus and was working at, I think, either Classic FM or Radio National, and was often helping produce or record stuff there.
Yeah.
And he asked if he could borrow a pair of Minotaurs and take them in to demonstrate to some of the studio engineers there, one of them being Alan McLean. Alan ended up buying a pair of CS-28s, but that's beside the point. Alan, I think this is right, and Phil can correct me. One of the engineers, it could have been Alan, heard them and really liked them. And then we got our first order in 1991 for a pair of, they weren't Minotaurs at the time, but the Metaphors. And then they started to buy more.
Yeah, okay.
And then I think we then started... I went out touting them to, I have a feeling my memory was that Triple J heard about them.
Okay.
Through an alternate source. Anyway, we managed to, the Triple J guys came to my place and they had a pair of LS35As with them. So they said, well, just want to get an idea.
Yep.
And I demonstrated the Minotaurs against the LS35As or with the LS35As. Yes. Yeah. And they decided to purchase some as well. Then that leaked through to Don Bartley from EMI Mastering Studios. And then I had to go and do a demonstration to some of the EMI people, including Don Bartley, who's a gun mastering engineer, great bloke. And so they ordered a few pairs of Minotaurs as mastering speakers.
Okay.
And it was sort of that thing where the word got spread around, and then suddenly we were getting orders for Classic FM, ABC Classic FM, for their listing studio or whatever. And then it started to go out to regional stations as well, Canberra.
Oh, okay. So there was
even my hometown Musselbrook had had a pair of Minotaurs there.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Where Philip Adams did his broadcast, his late night live broadcast.
Can you do it from Musselbrook?
He did. He lived up near Scone.
Yeah. Okay.
And he would do Sydney occasionally, but he did it from Musselbrook. So. That sounds all very egotistical, but just information. So we managed to snare ABC.
Completely impressive. So some of the finest voices at the ABC would have been listening to themselves. No, they would have used headphones, I guess. But it
they probably did.
Music, though, would have been great.
So Radio National, Triple J, Classic FM, then EMI 301 Mastering Studios. And then we even snared a couple of Channel 7 went out and did, I think we did some small speakers for the Andrew Denton show. I think it was Doug Mulroy. It was one of the things where the word got passed around. Sounds like a poem.
Indeed.
And then we managed to get Channel 10, I think that was again. But that was, I think Channel 10 was thanks to a guy called Glenn Carrick, another Carrick, another great fellow who's a passionate music lover and an audio buff. Channel 10 were looking for loudspeakers for monitoring and referencing sound because they're doing a whole lot of home theater surround sound stuff for Channel 10.
Okay.
And we put ours in amongst the,
Oh, so the rest they of the put out a tender kind of thing.
Yeah, that's the word, right, tender.
Yeah, okay.
And then we managed to snare that. So we ended up, again, this is sounding like a lot of bloody chest beating, but bugger it, I'll do it. We managed to get our speakers in the, maybe that was late 90s or early 2000s. We got them into Channel 10, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, I think. And I think Perth, but look, I'll have to update you on that. So look, the key thing was, that we harnessed that to promote the product to establish our bona fides.
Yeah.
And it helped psychologically knowing that there was a narrative we could lob to the dealers and customers that they look, we straddle both the sort of professional area in that sense, mastering and monitoring, and hopefully still make a musical product for everyday listeners like ourselves, Andrew. So
indeed. Yeah, well, that's
so that was a pivotal point for us. That
I knew about the breaking ABC. Through. Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't realize you'd. I had a feeling you'd done something with Channel 7, but the rest of it is. I wasn't so. I mean, EMI 301 is, of course, probably the. In the day when the music industry was banging along and there was money thrown around, it was the studio, certainly in Sydney at least, and. Yeah, very impressive stuff. So we're going to probably talk to some of these or talk more about the detail of those list of names you reeled off in future episodes. But because there's some very interesting people in there who are highly skilled and I'm sure have their own, tales to tell.
Yeah.
So sort of to wrap things up a little bit for today, you feel... we were going to sort of pinpoint I have my own reasons for wanting to do this, to pinpoint when the peak might have happened in volume. Mm. And of course, it's not that it peaked and then went away. And obviously, the brand continued on into the 2000s and really exists in some form still today.
Today, well,
there's a website. So I just wondered whether there was a tailing off of interest in Australian products, which we kind of know there was, and I just sort of am trying to pinpoint when that might have been. Probably into the 2000s, I would guess. But
I'm not sure whether the interest, whether Australians lost interest in Australian products. I think it's still, I still think that Australians are still very open to Aussie products designs.
Yeah.
But in terms of Orpheus, you're meaning Orpheus, in a sense, where I think we started to kick off was that sort of late 90s, where it felt like we were on the move.
Yep.
And around about that late 90s period, that's where Nick Hansen came into play. We had, and this is the thing about Kit. Kit was dynamic. He could build stuff. So he built a mezzanine level at Lugano, and he sort of at that stage, I think he ended up buying those premises. They were up for sale in Lugano. So he built a mezzanine level. We sort of were storing stuff there, and it started to get pretty crowded. So he ended up getting a factory at Peakhurst, which was a pretty big factory and a very reasonable price.
Yeah.
So we could store all the stock, the cabinets, and have a proper production line. It was a mezzanine level. I think it was already there, or maybe kit built. I can't remember. And that's around about that time we got that. We had a couple of fellas, two or three fellas doing assembly work. And then a fellow by the name of Nick Hansen popped into Audio Connection.
Okay.
And he was on holidays from the UK and was supposedly here for a year. And he
it's quite
was,
a holiday. Good. That's a oh, good, yeah. It's a good, decent length.
Chunky. Yeah. Yeah, it's a chunky holiday.
Yeah, yeah.
And now Nick was, my memory, what, how old was the bugger? I might have been 29, 30, something like
okay.
that. And he had worked at Wilson Benish as a, he had a degree as a mechatronic engineer, I think that was the term.
Okay.
And he worked, got a job at Wilson Benish. I think it was part of one of those programs where you can put someone on and the government pays you. But he turned out to be bloody more than useful. He did, they threw him in the deep end to do some design work. Or again, I've got to be careful what I say here. I can't remember whether he was working in association with other people, but he was doing design work and had a passion for music and a good ear. So he's out on holidays for a year, and he asked Audio Connection where he might be able to get some work, either selling hi-fi, because he obviously was passionate about it. And Joe Reitiger, I think, recommended that he call Orpheus.
Yeah, okay.
Well, call us, I should say.
Yeah.
And then I can remember going and picking him up and bringing him back down. And I think he was quite enthralled by the fact that I arrived in an HQ Holden and a 173-3 on the column, three on the column beast.
Oh, dear.
And I think it was the low compression one that was very economical.
Very economical. But I had you get that.
Yeah, I did have the suspension done, so it handled well. What's that? Yeah.
the suspension was good.
I modeled the suspension, Lovell springs, white line sway bars. I mean, it was an RTS version, the handling version.
Oh, the road train suspension system.
Yeah, so this thing could, its cruising speed around corners the same as its top speed. Anyway, around the corner. Anyway, upshot is that's badly told. So I went and picked up Nick, and they thought he just looked at me and said, he's a car. He was a car aficionado as well. Okay. He loved cars. So he got in the car and just thought that, oh, this is bizarre. He did love the fact that the air vents, when we were driving along the freeway section to get down to Lugano,
yep.
He flipped the air vent, and at a particular speed, it just kept on rotating like a fan. It was just brilliant. It just kept on rolling around in circles. And he just loved it. I thought, this guy's good. We've got to employ him. I don't care what he's like, but he gets it. So I drove there and drove him to Lugano. And he just said to us, he looked at our situation at the factory, said, oh, I know what I think we can do. This is the wrong way around. You should have it this way as far as, you know, the way you approach the assembly.
Yeah.
This, and this. And what salary would you like? He said, look, yeah, I'm happy to go with this, but I can guarantee you that I'm going to make a difference. He just, not cockily, but he said, look, I'm going to make a difference to your production and also just advice. Kietz said, yeah, let's do it. And I was right behind that. So great, what a great bloke. He got on with the blokes who were the uni students who were doing the assembly. He was just one of the guys, a perfect foil for Kiet and I. And I was over at Lugano, and
so he would Kiet kind of stand said, between you and stop the.
Oh no, Kiet and I. Kiet's my brother, my audio brother, and.
I just enjoy the stories of the V words, vim, vigor,
verve. Vivacious. Kiet was certainly vivacious. Vigorous. What he brought to it, again, he helped us in a big way. But not only that, he would bring over, so I'd be over at Lugano doing design work or whatever and listening, and Kiet would be at the fortress, the fort.
Yes.
And Nick would come over and sort of just check to see that I hadn't fallen asleep or something like that. That's what Kiet would say. And he'd come in and say, oh, hello, Brigadier. Cup of tea? Oh, yes, please. Cup of tea, thank you. Thank you, sir. Jolly good, sir. Tea? Sugar with that, sir? And all that sort of banter that we went on with, you know, pretending to be brigadiers. And he and I started to do a lot of listening together, as did Kiet. Kiet has a great set of ears. He would come over and listen with me, and then we started doing a bit of tuning of speakers together and throw ideas around. And so he would be popping over, not every day, but more often than not, you know, in there with a cup of tea, do a bit of listening tests, a bit of feedback. So he made a big difference to the way we progressed the business, but also from a design point of view, he was an excellent sort of person to work with with Kiet as well. So he kicked us off into the 2000s,
yeah,
if you like.
Okay, so really that was, you know, you were really kicking some goals and getting somewhere and sort of bringing some sort of first world sort of order to the production line, etc. So not implying that it was third world prior to that.
Oh, nothing wrong with third world, but
I'm
it was just
wondering
that we
about
was...
the second world. Where do you think that is? Is there a why does the second world not get more coverage?
Well, that's a great point, Andrew. I don't know. It must be the fact that they want to put a gap between the first and third.
I was going to say we need a decent gap, because when you have a look at the photos, there is clearly there's literally a world of difference. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't think anywhere's really third world anymore. I guess some places are, but anyhow, look. No. Hey,
a quick one.
Anywhere, but I feel like you do, and I don't want
I've got another 10.
No, you haven't. Minutes. I've been looking at the time, and
what time is it now, brother? Why am I saying brother?
Brother. Well, we've been going
6:45.
We've been going.
We've been going for
21 minutes.
Okay, I'll regale you with a quick story, and you can bung it in somewhere else or whatever. It relates to Nick.
Sure.
Okay, but it relates also to the fact that Kiet and I, Tony had left at some stage, and he actually went to get a proper job, actually earning proper money with Wharfedale and a few others, and he was very successful there. So Kit and I, with this battler mentality, you know, yes, we're battlers. Yeah. We can't afford to pay ourselves much money. So we decided, though, we need to go and see our dealers from Sydney all the way up the coast, all the way up to New South Wales coast and then into Queensland and then up further up.
Yep.
And we were doing it on the smell of an oily rag. And given our cars probably did leak oil, it was actually an oily rag. So if you allow me, the first stop when we went from Sydney to Taree, we visited Newcastle, the wonderful Terry Anderson and John Cornell, all those great blokes in Newcastle. And then a bit tired, so we thought we'd stop at a caravan park in Taree.
Mm,
perfectly fine establishment.
What a wonderful town.
Yeah, great town, Taree. A dear mate Ian Dodd hails from there. Anyway, so the toilets are a little bit funny, but look, there's
like
a bit of leakage.
I feel like I'm being more sarcastic about Taree than you are, but anyway, I've never seen so many potholes on the one road.
I have a lot of Taree friends, Peter Rupright and that sort of thing. I've got to be careful what I say.
Yeah, yeah,
but
I don't. So
on the Manning, on the mighty Manning River. See, the key thing is then we thought, okay, we then progressed up the coast and saw whoever we saw, and then we got to the mighty Regmill Stereo.
Mm.
And Regmill, great bloke with his Tony. Son, lovely people.
Oh, well, hang on. Yeah, I was going to say.
Tony Mills was the owner of his dad's shop.
Yes.
Yes, you're right.
I think the old man had already departed the scene at that point, but we'll see. Yeah.
Or might have retired.
I can't honestly remember, but yeah, Tony and his son. Yes, certainly. Yep.
Yeah. So Tony, really, really knowledgeable bloke. One of those just steady operators, knows his stuff, knew his stuff, and his son was a great bloke as well. So we managed to get Tony Mills on board.
Yes.
And we're tired. And we sort of said, Tony, which way should we go for accommodation? It was getting late. And he said, I'll just go south towards Mount Gravatt. Is it Gravatt or Cravat?
No, Gravatt. Yep.
Gravatt, yeah. Well, there's no cravats where we went. Let's put it that way. There's no esteemed English gentleman type with a scarf and all that sort of bookie stuff.
You didn't go to the joint where it's sort of down a dirt road or something, did you?
Yeah, yeah. So we went to this place which was we've stopped in to this motel. It looked very nice.
Oh, yeah.
Woo. And, I can't remember what year it was. It was in the mid-90s, something like that. And how much, Kit said to the lady at the front counter, and she said, I think I remember her saying, it's discounted this week. It's quiet, so it's $70 a night.
Okay.
Now, you know, that's quite expensive for those days. You know, $100 was very expensive in those days. And Kit said, nah, too expensive. So we rejected it.
Okay.
So this is getting late. And then we sort of drove further down the road and we saw a place called Mango Palms.
Okay. Mango
Palms. These beautiful Mango Palms, neon sign with, neon sign with it flickering on and off. Yeah, one with letters. and I think it was the O that was flickering. It was just man. So it's Mang Park.
That'd be it. Yeah. Mang.
Anyway, Mang Park. Mango Palms had a whole lot of mango trees.
Oh, palms, yeah. Not, yeah, Mang Palms.
Palms. There's a whole lot of mango trees there, and there's a dirt road. You
the whole
had to
point is, yeah, mango. What's a mango palm anyhow? I mean, there's a mango tree, which looks about as much like a palm tree as a ham sandwich. So, okay.
It's a fusion. It was a fusion of the mango and the palm tree, so it should have been a coconut.
Subtropical fusion.
Yeah, so it was I don't know. Whether he managed to get them to mate, I don't know, but the fact was it was a mango coconut that tastes like mango. I have no idea. Drove down this long dirt road, and there we arrived at this sort of old fibro place. And a bloke that looked like Bill Hunter came out, 6'4", with one of those... You know the whiskey nose, the veins and the...
Oh, yeah. Fairly red.
Big paws, lots of... And a ruddy face.
Yep.
And he came out and was very gruff and his wife was a or partner or whatever was petite and came scurrying out and to greet us, and it was something like, I can't remember, but let's embellish a little bit, $20 a night, like something like that.
So expensive,
very cheap. Exactly. So we were ushered into this esteemed establishment where there was a double bed and a single bed and an old TV up in the wall. And I thought, well, there's Friday night footy on. Or Thursday night footy, can't remember. It was my turn to sleep on the double bed, and Kit had the single.
Okay.
So I actually put my sleeping bag down, and Kit hopped into the bed, sans sleeping bag. And Kit's the sort of bloke that, unlike me, he likes to sleep with his top off and just have some sort of little scantily sort of, you know, little underwear or something like that. Boxer shorts or something like that. I'm all buttoned up, and I like to have a T-shirt on, and, you know, I don't want my skin touching any of the sheets. I'm on top of the sleeping bag, just sort of
condom-like sleeping bag that you're in as well.
Yeah, prophylactic, if you like. Yes. Yeah. And I'm lying on top of the bed watching the football, and Kit goes off to sleep. And half an hour goes by, and he's very tired from the driving. Half an hour goes by, and I can't show you, but I'll have to use words to describe the slightly erratic sound of him scratching.
Yes.
Scratching himself. And initially it was the odd scratch, and he's just itchy. And then it reaches sort of a spasmodic crescendo of him scratching, still asleep, mind you. And next minute, as only Kit could do, there's this this explosion. Fuck! Spelt P-H-A-R-K. Got out of bed, jumping around, scratching all over. And bugger me, he had these welts on him.
Yeah.
Bed bug. Bed bugs. And he was, itchy's all buggering for the whole night.
Oh, yeah.
He had to hop into the shower, and thankfully the hot water system was working, bung on the shower, put it to full bore heat,
yeah.
And then slept on top of his sleeping bag.
Burn
now,
those bed
what's the point?
Off.
Oh, yeah. So we didn't ask for our money back. We just scarpered early. Just didn't. Anyway, we get to Mackay. The guy takes the product on.
Yes.
This is Mackay. Fair drive. We're tired. Where are we going to stay? And I thought, oh, Christ, here we go again. What are we going to sleep on, you know? An ant's nest somewhere out in the bush or something? I just had no idea. And Kit sees the thing called Dolphin Head Resort.
Oh, yeah.
Off the highway.
Yeah.
Do you know it?
I was thinking of a different resort, out of town, down.
Yeah.
Is it called Black Beach or something? Black's Beach or something. It's not.
Could have been that, but it was Dolphin Head Resort.
Yeah,
Dolphin Head.
Yeah.
And he said, let's go have a look at that. And I said, gee, resort? That sounds pretty swish. Okay, we drove there and we got there, and my God, it was sort of this vista of opulence. You know, we went in to check it out, and no, we didn't. We made the call. Kit said, ring them. I don't know why I had to ring them. He said, ring them and see what they do. Do they do corporate rates? And they did.
They
dropped
rates.
Down. Yeah, corporate rates. And they just probably made it up and said, yeah, we do. And they said, oh, it's $130 a night, which after this offer of $70 a night the previous night, you'd think, well, no.
No, but.
And he said, and they came down a whopping $20 to $110 a night.
Yeah.
And I said, will you take that? He said, yeah, we're taking it. We're sleeping there. He'd been bitten, once bitten, twice shy,
absolutely,
is the old saying.
Yes.
And then we went in there, and there were swimming pools that were shaped all the way around the different rooms. So you could just go out of your room and dive into the pool and swim around to the sort of what it was, just a beautiful spot. And then instead of the shit that we ate, the stuff that we ate on the previous night, we had, I think, kangaroo on, not that I ate the kangaroo, but kangaroo on paper bark.
Okay.
You know, it was sort of an esoteric sort of menu. I must say that we never, ever stayed in accommodation that was No, we didn't rough it again.
No.
Then we segue to Nick Hansen.
Yes.
So when Nick joined us, a bit after that, when Nick was going to leave after he stayed for 3 years, and we couldn't get an extension on his visa anymore. We went down to reignite the Melbourne market.
Yes.
And we stayed in the CBD in some really swish hotel. And Kit decided we weren't to ever suffer again. We had to go out feeling fresh and vital and that we're worthy.
He worked it out.
So, yeah. So that was sort of the story of how we used to go out with the battler mentality
transition from doing it not so much on the cheap, but keeping the overheads to a minimum, but getting the road to actually living and having a successful business and actually reaping some of the benefits of that.
We still didn't pay us. We were just careful with.
We still weren't making any money. We were just staying in better hotels. So yeah, I think we may have had a battery failure there at some point. We may have lost a couple of seconds, and I won't quite know where yet. So let's backtrack just a touch. So I think we were saying that with Nick Hansen's input, things were optimized.
So there were the pivot points were or turning points in football parlance. Kit Lowe and Tony Wong, and Nick Hansen arriving on the scene, and then there's another guy called James Galloway that also was working there as a university student, very bright young fellow that sort of came to the fore in the 2000s.
Yeah, okay.
But they were the two pivot points as far as people. We had wonderful helpers along the way. People that sort of helped out and helped us move forward. Obviously, Phil Carrick and Glenn Carrick and Don Bartley. So a few pivotal things, sort of cracking the ABC as well. So
just completely impressive. I had no idea that you'd made as many inroads as you did into broadcasting. And, for all, obviously, the right reasons, the product worked, sounded great, was enough of a monitor loudspeaker to do the job they required, but at the same time, I remember that loudspeaker is a very sweet listen, and I don't think I sold too many, because back in the day, let's face it, that was a relatively expensive loudspeaker for its size, at least for me, but it was a premium product. So, thank you again, Brad Sirhan.
Thank you, Andrew.
Well, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Great stuff. All right, talk to you again.
Chat soon, mate. Bye.